like chocolate because I'm a chocolate-holic. So that's probably my favorite flavor.
And Chloe doesn't just love eating cupcakes. She loves making cupcakes. And she was so good at it, she started selling them out of her mom's kitchen. She'd sell them at school, birthday parties. She and her mom told the local newspaper that Chloe's business was clearing something like $200 a month.
People would come to a kid's birthday party and have a cupcake and say, "Oh my gosh, where'd you get these from?"
And for 2 years, business was pretty good. Chloe and her mom thought she'd even save enough money for a car by the time she was 16. But then...
Well, the health department called and they said I can't bake anymore because I don't have a business license. It's like, I kind of get that I needed one. It's like, I guess they're right. Like, you need a permit to sell it to people.
We heard about this story from Philip Howard. He's a lawyer who keeps track of these kinds of stories.
The authorities shut her down because she needed to either buy a bakery or build a separate kitchen under the health codes. Well, we are increasingly moving towards this almost rule-based fetish about law, where it's not a question of what's right and wrong anymore. It's a question of, did you comply? And if you didn't comply, throw the book at them.
And Chloe didn't even get mad about it. She just accepted that that's the way it is.
I've learned that to run a business like this, that you have to follow the rules and you have to get certain stuff so you can give them out and sell them.
Chloe just wants to give out cupcakes and sell them. But the legal system we built to protect us can't always accommodate common sense like Chloe and her cupcakes. So today on the show, we're going to hear from four TED speakers with four ideas about how to solve it. Fix our broken systems.
I mean, recently, a lifelong employee of the D.C. Parks Department had a heart attack in front of a fire station. The fireman watched and didn't help him out because the rule said you're supposed to call 911. So someone called 911, and the ambulance happened to go to the wrong quadrant of the District of Columbia, and the man died. They were following the rules.
And it's stories like this one that drive Philip Howard and a lot of people crazy because the law, in many cases, has become so difficult to understand and interpret and change. Here's another story Philip tells on the TED stage.
A couple of years ago, I was hiking near Cody, Wyoming. It was in a grizzly bear preserve, although no one told me that before we went. And our guide was a local science teacher. She was wholly unconcerned about the bears, but she was terrified of lawyers. The story started pouring out. She'd just been involved in an episode where a parent had threatened to sue the school because she lowered the grade of the student by 10% because he turned the paper in late. The principal didn't want to stand up to the parent because he didn't want to get dragged into some legal proceedings. So she had to go to the meeting after meeting, same arguments made over and over again. After 30 days of sleepless nights, she finally capitulated and raised the grade. She said, "Life's too short. I just can't keep going with this. At the end of this day, I could have filled a book just with stories about law from this one teacher." Now, we've been taught to believe that law is the foundation of freedom, but somehow or another in the last couple of decades, the land of the free has become a legal minefield.
So I hear this and I'm thinking, you can understand this teacher. I mean, yes, she's probably a person of integrity and principle, but at a certain point, she was just sort of like, forget principle. This is too powerful to fight.
Right. And so let's take that apart. So the first problem in that story is that the principal wouldn't stand up for her. So the principal should have told the father who was threatening to sue, go jump in a lake. That's the rule in this classroom. Everybody knew it, period. Then let's say the father acts on his threat and brings a lawsuit. Then the judge must call a conference immediately and say, I'm going to give you 5 minutes to withdraw this claim. Otherwise, I'm going to sanction you for costs for abusing the offices of the court. There is no cause of action for excuses for turning in a school paper late.
So more laws mean more chaos then.
It's definitely made. And so what we have is a combination of anarchy and public paralysis. There's this fetish with rules that has kind of replaced morality, and it works both in a gotcha sort of way, and it works in an avoidance of responsibility sort of way, and it's infected our political culture and our broader culture.
Tort reformers have been sounding the alarm that lawsuits are out of control, and we read, you know, every once in a while about these crazy lawsuits, like the guy in the District of Columbia who sued his dry cleaners for $54 million because they lost his pair of pants. My favorite, though, are all the warning labels. Caution, contents are hot, on billions of coffee cups. My favorite warning was one on a 5-inch fishing lure. I grew up in the South and whiled away the summers fishing. 5-inch fishing lure, it was a big fishing lure with a 3-pronged hook in the back. And outside it said, harmful if swallowed. So none of these people are doing what they think is right. And why not? They don't trust the law. Why don't they trust the law? Because it gives us the worst of both worlds. It's random. Anybody can sue for almost anything and take it to a jury. No, not even an effort at consistency. And it's also too detailed. In the areas that are regulated, there's so many rules, no human could possibly know it. So what do we do about it? We certainly don't want to give up the rights when people do something wrong to seek redress in the courts. We need regulation to make sure people don't pollute and such. We lack even a vocabulary to deal with this problem. And that's because we have the wrong frame of reference. Law has to be simple enough so that people can internalize it in their daily choices. If they can't internalize it, they won't trust it. And how do you make it simple? Because life is complex. And here is the hardest and biggest change. We have to restore the authority to judges and officials to interpret and apply the law. We have to rehumanize the law. To make law simple so that you feel free, the people in charge have to be free to use their judgment to interpret and apply the law in accord with reasonable social norms. As you're going down and walking down the sidewalk during the day, you have to think that if there's a dispute, there's somebody in society who sees it as their job to affirmatively protect you if you're acting reasonably. That person doesn't exist today.
It seems like the heart of your idea isn't so much about a broken legal system, but about the corrosion of authority. Like, we went through a period in our history where we became extremely skeptical of authority, and we're still kind of reacting to that.
That's absolutely right. We no longer believe that any human should have even the provisional flexibility to decide right and wrong. So authority in a public position should be something that's more like a job. It's bounded by legal principles. It doesn't mean people can do whatever they want. That's not unfettered discretion. It's someone who has a set of boundaries around them where the person inside has room to do what's right. Instead, we've created this legal stranglehold on everyone where people are not allowed to do what right, and now they're conditioned to simply ask, what does the rule require, rather than what's the right thing to do?
But why? I mean, what are they afraid of? Why is that happening?
Well, the way they would say it is, we're not supposed to be activists. We are just supposed to be neutral referees to make sure everybody can make their claim. And my response to that is, no, that's not true. You're supposed to be judges. And law requires affirmative assertions of norms of right and wrong. Judges must actually draw the boundaries of what a reasonable dispute is. Otherwise, everyone loses their freedom. And pretty soon, anybody can get away with pretty much anything.
How do we get those people to feel like they can make those judgments? Like, how do we actually make that happen?
It's actually not as hard as it sounds. We need to rewrite and radically simplify and rehumanize the structure of public law in our society. where we safeguard against abuses with human checks and balances, where other people have the authority to use their judgment, and where you go area by area and you simply take 10,000 pages or 100,000 pages of law and you turn it into something that much more closely resembles a pamphlet. What's hard is creating the public momentum to abandon the current structure, because your every interest group has a stake in the current system. So let's appoint a whole bunch of independent commissions to come up with proposals about how to make things work. It would be trying to let government become human again.
We've been taught that authority is the enemy of freedom. It's not true. Authority, in fact, is essential to freedom. Law is a human institution. Responsibility is a human institution. If teachers don't have authority to run the classroom, to maintain order, everybody's learning suffers. If the judge doesn't have authority to toss out unreasonable claims, then all of us go through the day looking over our shoulders. A free society requires red lights and green lights. Otherwise, it soon descends into gridlock. That's what's happened to America. Look around. So what the world needs now is to restore the authority to make common choices. It's the only way to get our freedom back, and it's the only way to release the energy and passion needed so that we can meet the challenges of our time. Thank you.
Philip Howard, he's a lawyer who's written a book about how he could start to change all this. It's called The Rule of Nobody. Check out his full talk at ted.npr.org. Oh, and about Chloe Sterling, the 11-year-old cupcake entrepreneur. Well, after the county shut her down, a local contractor heard about the story and built her a commercial-grade kitchen for free. And Chloe's Cupcake Kitchen is back in business. Stay with us. More on Solving It in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jon Stewart talks about writing and directing the new film Rosewater, adapted from the memoir by journalist Mazyar Bahari, who was imprisoned in Iran in 2009 while covering the Iranian election. He was accused of being a spy. Part of the evidence used against him was the satirical sketch he appeared in on The Daily Show. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For over 20 years, Silver Creek has served fresh and seasonally current dinners by the fireplace and warm wood ambience. Silver Creek also offers over 100 fine wines and draft beers.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and our show today, Solving It. Four ideas about solving systems in the U.S. that seem a little, well, broken. Like the political system. So say you want to run for Congress. Well, these days, it'll cost you between $1 and $2 million just to run. Millions more if you want to be in the Senate.
I think most Americans would be shocked, not surprised, but shocked, if they knew how much time a United States senator spends raising money.
So that is an actual senator, Dick Durbin from Illinois. And he told NPR that if you are a politician in America, then raising money, it's basically your second job.
Talking about raising money and thinking about raising money and planning to raise money and, you know, going off on little retreats and conjuring up new ideas on how to raise money.
You know, they spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time calling people, attending fundraisers to raise money.
This is Lawrence Lessig.
I'm a professor at Harvard University.
And he says that this second job, constantly raising money, it's this weird thing where everyone who does it knows there's something kind of seedy about it. So they even have a rule that says congressmen and senators can't raise money from their government offices.
So they race off Capitol Hill to these call centers just next to Capitol Hill. There's one for Democrats, one for Republicans. And
we sit at these desks with stacks of names in front of us.
Lists of people.
And short bios and histories of giving.
That they simply sit there dialing, 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 dialing through the lists, calling people to ask for money.
And this goes on and on and on and on and on.
You know, at Harvard, B.F. Skinner, the psychologist, created this image of the Skinner box, where, you know, a rat or a pigeon learns which buttons to push in order to get the food that the rat or the pigeon wants to survive. If you look at that image of the Skinner box, I think you see a pretty good picture of the modern American congressperson, because what they're doing for those 2 or 3 or 4 hours a day is just intuitively learning what they need to say, what they need to do to raise money.
But not raising money from ordinary people, but from Lesters. And this is a story Larry Lessig tells on the TED stage. In the U.S., there are about 144,000 people named Lester. Now imagine those 144,000 Lesters were given extraordinary power, enough power to rename the country. Lesterland.
So 144,000 are called Lester, which means about 0.05% is named Lester. Now, Lesters and Lesterland have this extraordinary power. There are two elections every election cycle in Lesterland. One is called the general election. The other is called the Lester election. And in the general election, it's the citizens who get to vote. But in the Lester election, it's the Lesters who get to vote. And here's the trick. In order to run in the general election, you must do extremely well in the Lester election. Now, what can we say about democracy in Lesterland? Number one, United States is Lesterland.
Okay, maybe you saw that one coming. But Larry Lessig is serious about this. In the U.S., the number of people who have real influence over the political system is the same number of people named Lester, 0.05% of the population.
Now you say, really? Really? 0.05%? Well, here are the numbers from 2010. 0.26% of America gave $200 or more to any federal candidate. 0.05% gave the maximum amount to any federal candidate. 0.01%, the 1% of the 1%, gave $10,000 or more to federal candidates. And in this election cycle, my favorite statistic is 0.000042%. For those of you doing the numbers, you know that's 132 Americans gave 60% of the super PAC money spent in the cycle we have just seen ending. So I'm just a lawyer. I look at this range of numbers, and I say it's fair for me to say it's 0.05% who are irrelevant funders in America. In this sense, the funders are our Lesters.
Now, money in politics isn't new, right? But it is bigger than ever. And one reason is Citizens United, that U.S. Supreme Court decision that all but eliminated restrictions on election spending by outside groups. And the other one, well, you can trace it back to 1995, when leaders in Congress shortened the work week.
They show up, they start voting on Tuesday night, they hang around for a couple days, and then they're supposed to leave the Capitol, not move their families to the Capitol.
And the idea was for them to spend more time in their home districts, but it also meant they spent less time with each other. They stopped hanging out and building friendships across party lines and basically became competitors instead of collaborators.
What the competition between the Democrats and Republicans has done is radically increase the cost of campaigns so that they need to spend, you know, anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time calling people to ask for money.
And the question we need to ask is, what does it do to them, these humans, as they spend their time behind the telephone calling people they've never met, but calling the tiniest slice of the 1%? As anyone would, as they do this, they develop a sixth sense, a constant awareness about how what they do might affect their ability to raise money. They become, in the words of the X-Files, shapeshifters, as they constantly adjust their views in light of what they know will help them to raise money, not on issues 1 to 10, but on issues 11 to 1,000. Okay, now, every single one of you know this, yet you ignore it. You ignore it. This is an impossible problem. You focus on the possible problems. like eradicating polio from the world, or taking an image of every single street across the globe, or building a fusion factory in your garage. These are the manageable problems, so you ignore... So you ignore this corruption, but we cannot ignore this corruption anymore, because there is no sensible reform possible until we end this corruption. So I want you to take hold, to grab the issue you care the most about. Climate change is mine, but it might be financial reform or a simpler tax system or inequality. Grab that issue, sit it down in front of you, look straight in its eyes and tell it there is no Christmas this year. There will never be a Christmas. We will never get your issue solved until we fix this issue first. So it's not that mine is the most important issue. It's not. Yours is the most important issue, but mine is the first issue. The issue we have to solve before we get to fix the issues you care about. No sensible reform, and we cannot afford a future with no sensible reform.
Larry Lessig's big idea isn't to eliminate money from politics altogether. Instead, he wants a system where money is given to voters, like a tax rebate, $50, $100, say, right? And then you, the voter, could give that money to whichever candidate you want. There would be just as much money available to each candidate as before. It would just come from a wider range of people.
If you, as a member of Congress, were thinking, how do I raise my money, not from the 0.05% from the 150,000 Americans who are funding campaigns right now, but from the millions who could possibly be funding your campaign in small dollar contributions, you would be much more keenly focused on the need to appeal to a wider range of Americans.
What would you have to do to make that change?
It would simply require a statute in Congress. So, for example, Congressman John Sarbanes, a Democrat from Maryland, has what he's calling the Government by the People Act. And that statute would create small dollar funded elections where candidates would be raising money from the wide, vast array of Americans as opposed to the tiny fraction of the 1%. Or the Americans Anti-Corruption Act, pushed by a group called Represent Us, would create a $100 voucher that everybody would use to help fund campaigns. Again, radically changing the way we fund campaigns. Those statutes could be enacted without any constitutional change if we created the political movement to force Congress to actually adopt it.
This is a solvable issue. If you think about the issues our parents tried to solve in the 20th century, issues like racism or sexism, or the issue that we've been fighting in this century, homophobia, those are hard issues. But this is a problem of just incentives. Just incentives. Change the incentives and the behavior changes. And the states that have adopted small dollar funded systems have seen overnight a change in the practice. When Connecticut adopted this system in the very first year, 78% of the elected representatives gave up large contributions and took small contributions only. It's solvable. Not by being a Democrat, not by being a Republican. It's solvable by being citizens. By being citizens. Thank you very much.
Larry Lessig wrote about his idea in the book Lesterland. He's given 3 TED Talks, including this one called We the People. Check it out at ted.npr.org. About 10 years ago, when she was a student in Boston, Rebecca Oney started to volunteer at a local hospital. And the more time she spent there, the more she realized that the healthcare system was ignoring an obvious problem. Rebecca picks up the story from the TED stage.
The doctors, it seemed, never really had enough time for all the patients, try as they might. And over the course of 6 months, I would corner them in the hallway and ask them a sort of naive but fundamental question. If you had unlimited resources, what's the one thing you would give your patients? And I heard the same story again and again, a story we've heard hundreds of times since then. They said, every day we have patients that come into the clinic. Child has an ear infection. I prescribe antibiotics. But the real issue is there's no food at home. The real issue is that child is living with 12 other people in a two-bedroom apartment, and I don't even ask about those issues because there's nothing I can do. I have 13 minutes with each patient. Patients are piling up in the clinic waiting room. I have no idea where the nearest food pantry is, and I don't even have any help.
So Rebecca came up with a plan, and she started something called Health Leads. And the purpose was to help patients have the infrastructure at home, not just to get better, but to stay healthy.
And we asked, not what do patients need to get healthy? Antibiotics and inhaler medication. But what do patients need to be healthy, to not get sick in the first place? And we chose to use the prescription for that purpose. Doctors and nurses can prescribe nutritious food, heat in the winter, and other basic resources for their patients the same way they prescribe medication. Patients then take their prescriptions to our desk in the clinic waiting room, where we have a core of well-trained college student advocates who work side by side with these families to connect them out to the existing landscape of community resources. So just a few miles from here at Children's National Medical Center, when patients come into the doctor's office, they're asked a few questions. They're asked, are you running out of food at the end of the month? Do you have safe housing? Is the family living in a shelter?
Are you worried about food? Are you worried about housing? Do you need help getting a job? And when the doctor begins the visit with the patient, they can now talk about the fact that, you know, not only does he need a refill for his inhaler for his asthma, but he also needs help getting his heat turned back on so that the cold air in his apartment doesn't keep triggering his asthma. And when they talk about that, the doctor can actually act on it, right? She can prescribe heat.
So the patients, like, show up at the desk and they say, I've got a prescription for heat. And then what happens? I mean, can the volunteers, like, literally call up utility companies?
They literally call up utilities companies. And a lot of utilities companies actually have plans for people who can't afford to pay their bills. And they'll be able to work with the patient to figure out a payment plan over time. So yes, it's using the clinic to bridge patients from the doctor's office directly to those resources that they need to be healthy.
I mean, it's almost like a reimagination of how doctors and patients should and will maybe interact.
And I think that's the real transformation, is how do we reimagine healthcare so that the doctor can prescribe a cardiologist for a patient and the doctor can prescribe getting heat for the patient. That's the whole notion, is how do we make being able to refer a patient to the utilities company as integral a tool to the way healthcare is delivered as referring the patient to the ophthalmologist.
What's so interesting to me about this idea is that it's actually kind of simple.
When I talk about this idea, people will often come up to me and say, you know, no offense, but it's really obvious. And which is, like, to me, the ultimate compliment. But the funny part is to say, well, no offense, but then why aren't we doing it?
My belief is that it's almost too painful to articulate our aspirations for our healthcare system or even admit that we have any at all. Because if we did, they would be so removed from our current reality. But that doesn't change my belief that all of us deep inside share a similar set of desires. That if we are honest with ourselves and listen quietly, that we all harbor one fiercely held aspiration for our healthcare, that it keep us healthy.
So after you gave your talk, what happened? Like, did people all of a sudden start contacting you and saying, oh, we want to do this at our hospital, and how can we start this?
Yeah, the TED Talk was the most extraordinary opening of floodgates that we could have possibly imagined. I think, you know, over the past couple of years, we've had 850 expansion requests for health leads from health systems and health departments and hospitals and doctor's offices all across the country. What we hadn't anticipated was how powerfully we were articulating a vision for healthcare that was already out there, but just hadn't been made real yet.
What do you hope that the healthcare system looks like, especially for poor people, in like 10 years?
Yeah, I'd love I'd love for us to not even be having this conversation in 10 years. When you go into the doctor's office, the doctor asks you whether you need a set of basic resources to be healthy. And when you as a patient say yes, that it's just a prescription or a referral away, and that this is just how care is provided. It's so much part of how healthcare is that we don't even have to talk about it anymore.
You know, the way I think about this is that healthcare is like any other system. It's just a set of choices that people make. What if we decided to make a different set of choices? What if we decided to take all the parts of healthcare that have drifted away from us and stand firm and say, no, these things are ours. They will be used for our purposes. They will be used to realize our aspiration. What if everything we needed to realize our aspiration for healthcare was right there in front of us, just waiting to be claimed? I believe that at the end of the day, when we measure our healthcare, it will not be by the diseases cured, but by the diseases prevented. It will not be by the excellence of our technologies or the sophistication of our specialists, but by how rarely we needed them. And most of all, I believe that when we measure healthcare, it will be not by what the system was, but by what we chose it to be. Thank you.
Rebecca Oney is the co-founder and CEO of HealthLeads, which now serves about 14,000 patients a year. You can see her entire talk at TED.com. In a moment, fixing the criminal justice system. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from Zurich, providing risk management and insurance solutions for those who truly love their business. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. From Subaru, featuring the all-new Subaru Outback. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Delta Airlines, whose new Delta Studio provides all kinds of entertainment in the sky. Delta, keep climbing. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
Join WILL and Mid-American Gardener this July as we explore the magnificent gardens of Germany. I'm Diane Nolan, host of Mid-American Gardener, and I'll be with you on this 9-day journey as we experience the stunning gardens and castles of Germany, including large formal gardens and small privately owned gardens. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go online to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a public workshop on music, Jews, and globalization, sharing perspectives on the reshaping of Jewish musical life since the 19th century, November 17th and 18th. The full schedule is at cas.illinois.edu.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on today's show, solving it. Ideas on how to fix some of our broken systems. So back in the 1980s, Brian Stevenson was suffering through his first year of law school. He just hated it. Tort, civil procedure, contracts, just totally miserable. But that all changed after he got an internship with a very small law firm in Georgia.
And what really sealed the deal for me was when they asked me to go to death row and just explain to someone who they hadn't had time to meet that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next year. And I went down there and spent time with this man, and I was really nervous and was very, very stressed out about talking to a condemned person when I didn't know very much about the appeals process. I didn't know much criminal law. I didn't know much procedure. But when I got there and I explained to that man that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next 12 months, he grabbed my hands and said, "Say that again." And I said it again. I said, "You're not at risk of execution any time in the next 12 months. And he said, "Say that again." And I said it again. I said, "You're not at risk of execution any time in the next 12 months. And we just fell into this deep conversation that was incredibly affirming for me. And I learned that proximity to people who are suffering, who are in need, who are condemned, who are excluded, who are marginalized, can be transformative. And even if you don't feel fully prepared for it, it has a way of energizing you. And I wanted to be the kind of lawyer that could make a difference in the lives of people who were very vulnerable.
And since that experience, Brian started the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. He's trying to fix what he thinks is broken about our criminal justice system. Here's Brian on the TED stage.
This country is very different today than it was 40 years ago. In 1972, there were 300,000 people in jails and prisons. Today, there are 2.3 million. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We have 7 million people on probation and parole, and mass incarceration, in my judgment, has fundamentally changed our world. In poor communities and communities of color, there is this despair, there is this hopelessness that is being shaped by these outcomes. One out of three black men between the ages of 18 and 30 is in jail, in prison, on probation, or parole. Our system isn't just being shaped in these ways that seem to be distorting around race, they're also distorted by poverty. We have a system of justice in this country that treats you much better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes. And yet we seem to be very comfortable. The politics of fear and anger has made us believe that these are problems that are not our problems. We've been disconnected. My state of Alabama, like a number of states, actually permanently disenfranchises you if you have a criminal conviction. Right now in Alabama, 34% of the black male population has permanently lost the right to vote. We're actually projecting in another 10 years, the level of disenfranchisement will be as high as it's been since prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and there is this stunning silence.
So how is that possible?
When I was born, the expectation was not that one in three black babies would go to jail or prison. That's true today in ways that has never been true before. You know, we still have, you know, over 40% of children of color living below the federal poverty level. They're growing up in communities that are just as racially segregated as the community I grew up in. They go to schools where there are no white students or white teachers. They're being threatened by a criminal justice system that will arrest them, that is teaching them in subtle and direct ways that they are destined for jail and prison. And in many ways, their struggle is not unlike the struggle of their parents and grandparents and their great-grandparents.
And that's especially true when it comes to questions like, who ends up on death row and who doesn't?
In the states of the old South, we execute people. Where you're 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is white than if the victim is black, 22 times more likely to get it if the defendant is black and the victim is white. In the very states where there are buried in the ground the bodies of people who were lynched, and yet there is this disconnect. In many ways, we've been taught to think that the real question is, do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? And that's a very sensible question. The other way of thinking about it is not, do people deserve to die for the crimes they commit, but do we deserve to kill? Well, I talk a lot about these issues. I talk about a race and this question of whether we deserve to kill. And it's interesting, when I teach my students about African-American history, I tell them about slavery. I tell them about terrorism, the era that began at the end of Reconstruction that went on to World War II. We don't really know very much about it, but for African-Americans in this country, that was an era defined by terror. In many communities, people had to worry about being lynched. They had to worry about being bombed. It was the threat of terror that shaped their lives. And these older people come up to me now. They tell me to say, you know, tell them that we grew up with that. And that era of terrorism, was followed by segregation, decades of racial subordination and apartheid. And yet we have in this country this dynamic where we really don't like to talk about our problems. We don't like to talk about our history. And because of that, we really haven't understood what it's meant to do the things we've done historically. And we're constantly running into each other. We're constantly creating tensions and conflicts. We have a hard time talking about race. And I believe it's because we are unwilling to
to commit ourselves to a process of truth and reconciliation. In South Africa, people understood that we couldn't overcome apartheid without a commitment to truth and reconciliation. In Rwanda, even after the genocide, there was this commitment. But in this country, we haven't done that.
You know when you, like, you love somebody, or there's something painful that happens between you and somebody else, right? And it's very hard to confront it and to deal with it, and oftentimes it destroys relationships, right? You right. just don't want to talk about it. And for a variety of reasons, maybe it's pride or fear of reprisal or ego, and that's on a very small human-to-human scale, right?
Right.
And then you think about a bigger, much bigger scale, and so you begin to say, well, why is it so hard for a society to talk about that? Like, is it about guilt? Is it about shame? Is it about fear of what might come next? Like, you must have asked yourself this question, why can't America do that?
Well, I think it is all of those things. I think that we do want to be proud, as everyone does. We are afraid that we might lose power to acknowledge our weakness, our failure. And we actually have never developed a political tradition that values remedy, that values apology, that values humility. And I think we have to make that transition. I really do. I think this country will be a healthier place, a stronger place, when we actually embrace the humility that is required when you're trying to do complex things. You know, when we start talking about apologies and reflecting on things like, you know, slavery or terrorism or lynching or civil rights or a whole host of things, it shouldn't make us fearful and worried about whether we're going to give up power. It ought to make us excited that we finally have a chance to do something to deal with this still festering wound, because we're not going to become strong and healthy until we do that. And it's not something we have in our national DNA to practice humility, to practice reflection on our mistakes, our abuses. But I think we have to cultivate that if we're going to become the kind of society we want. Well, I believe that our identity is at risk. That when we actually don't care about these difficult things, the positive and wonderful things are nonetheless implicated. We love innovation. We love technology. We love creativity. We love entertainment. But ultimately, those realities are shadowed by suffering, abuse, degradation, marginalization. And for me, it becomes necessary to integrate the two. Because ultimately, we are talking about a need to be more hopeful, more committed, more dedicated to the basic challenges of living in a complex world. And for me, that means spending time thinking and talking about the poor, the disadvantaged, those who will never get to TED, but thinking about them in a way that is integrated in our own lives. Vaclav Havel, the great Czech leader, talked about this. He said, when we were in Eastern Europe and dealing with oppression, we wanted all kinds of things, but mostly what we needed was hope, an orientation of the spirit, a willingness to sometimes be in hopeless places and be a witness. Well, that orientation of the spirit is very much at the core of what I believe even TED communities have to be engaged in. Now, I will warn you that this kind of identity is a much more challenging identity than ones that don't pay attention to this. It will get to you. I had the great privilege when I was a young lawyer of meeting Rosa Parks, and Ms. Parks used to come back to Montgomery every now and then, and she would get together with two of her dearest friends, these older women, Johnny Carr, who was the organizer of the Montgomery bus boycott, an amazing African-American woman, and Virginia Durr, a white woman whose husband, Clifford Durr, represented Dr. King, and these women would get together and just talk. And every now and then, Ms. Carr would call me, and she'd say, Brian, Ms. Parks is coming to town, and we're going to get together and talk. Do you want to come over and listen? And I'd say, yes, ma'am, I do. And she said, well, what are you going to do when you get here? I said, I'm going to listen. And I'd go over there, and I would just listen. It would be so energizing and so empowering. And one time, I was over there listening to these women talk, and after a couple of hours, Ms. Parks turned to me, and she said, now, Brian, tell me what the Equal Justice Initiative is. Tell me what you're trying to do. I began giving her my rap. I said, well, we're trying to challenge injustice. We're trying to help people who've been wrongly convicted. We're trying to confront bias and discrimination in the administration of criminal justice. We're trying to end life without parole sentences for children. We're trying to do something about the death penalty. We're trying to reduce the prison population. We're trying to end mass incarceration. I gave her my whole rap, and when I finished, she looked at me and she said, She said, that's going to make you tired, tired, tired. And that's when Ms. Carr leaned forward. She put her finger in my face and said, that's why you've got to be brave, brave, brave. And I actually believe that the TED community needs to be more courageous. We need to find ways to embrace these challenges, these problems, the suffering. Because ultimately, our humanity depends on everyone's humanity. Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think if somebody takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. And because of that, there's this basic human dignity that must be respected by law. I also believe that in many parts of this country, that the opposite of poverty is not wealth. I actually think in too many places, the opposite of poverty is justice. And finally, I believe, we will ultimately not be judged by our technology. We won't be judged by our design. We won't be judged by our intellect and reason. Ultimately, you judge the character of a society, not by how they treat the rich and the powerful and the privileged, but by how they treat the poor, the condemned, the incarcerated. Because it's in that nexus that we actually begin to understand truly profound things about who we are. I've come to TED because I believe that many of you understand that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. That we cannot be full, evolved human beings until we care about human rights and basic dignity. That all of our survival is tied to the survival of everyone. That our visions of technology and design and entertainment and creativity have to be married with the visions of humanity, compassion, and justice. And more than anything, for those of you who share that, I've simply come to tell you to keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Thank you very much.
Your standing ovation, I think, is still holds a record for the longest in TED history. You struck a chord when you spoke there, and when it was over, people didn't want to stop. They wanted to be part of that, part of what you want everybody, I guess, to be part of.
Well, people were really kind, and I was very moved by that. And I'm frequently moved by the capacity of other human beings to, say, carry on, to do something compassionate, to do something energizing. You know, that audience, you know, reflected a little bit of that is very encouraging. I just gave a talk in a poor rural church in the Black Belt of Alabama not too long ago, and there was an older man in a wheelchair there. And this man was staring at me the whole time I was talking. He had a very intense expression. And after people came up, they were very kind, shaking hands, and he just sat there in his chair, and he had a little boy wheel him up to me. And the man came up to me, and he said, do you know what you're doing? And he had this very stern look on his face, and he started pointing his finger. And I was actually taken aback. I just didn't say anything. I stood back. I said, I didn't say anything. He said it again. He said, do you know what you're doing? And I said, I think so, sir. I said, I don't know. And then he looked at me and he said, I'll tell you what you're doing. He said, you're beating the drum for justice. And he said, come here. Look here. He said, you see this bruise I got on the back of my neck? He said, I got that bruise in Greene County, Alabama, trying to register people to vote in 1961. He said, you see the scar I have on my forehead? He said, I got that scar in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963. He said, you see this cut over here? I got that in Selma, Alabama. He said, people look at me and they think they see cuts and bruises and scars. And then he said to me, he said, these aren't my cuts and bruises. He said, these are my medals of honor. And he said, the greatest thing I can hope for you is that you are covered with medals of honor when you finish beating the drum. And it's stuff like that that is so empowering to me and so energizing to me. And whether you're affluent or poor, there are ways of expressing to the human beings around you that it makes sense to struggle for justice, that it makes sense to fight for peace and justice and to protect basic human rights and dignity. And so it is a constant struggle in my mind. And where people are prepared to struggle and motivated to struggle and committed to struggle, then you can have great hope of justice.
That's Brian Stevenson. His group, the Equal Justice Initiative, just marked its 25th anniversary. You can watch his full talk at ted.npr.org. Thanks for listening to the show, Solving It, this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Daniel Shukin, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Our intern is Rund Abdel-Fattah. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Gotta, give me a